hand over to Ian. Ian and I are colleagues in a crazy initiative, a kind of close to $1 billion big bet of the Atlantic Philanthropies around social change leadership. And Ian is involved in the brain health aspect of that. Ian's Professor of Psychology at Trinity Dublin and founding director of the Trinity College Institute of Neuroscience. And where we met was particularly around Ian's work on the brain's attention systems and the new theory about how socioeconomic factors such as poor education and social deprivation interact with the biology of the brain to increase the risk of dementia. His books, one of which I read and I think even understood, which says, we don't know what that says about me or you, Ian, is The Winner Effect, How Power Affects Your Brain, and The Stress Test, How Pressure Can Make You Stronger and Smarter. And we talked about the theme of this roundtable, and Ian pointed out to me that, of course, what we bring in to our workplaces, how we organise our own thinking and our own selves, has a huge influence on how our organisations then learn and how we interact with those. So it's that theme of the learning brain that we've asked Ian to speak on. Ian will speak for around 15 minutes, and then there'll be a bit of time to reflect and then a bit of time to talk with Ian before we move into the cases. So, Ian, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I've learned a lot in interacting with Ben's colleagues who sat on our meetings and initially when we set up the Global Brain Health Institute, the idea that you had evaluators with you all the time, it was really stressful. and the whole concept that after every executive meeting, you had to not only summarize the meeting, but think, what have we learned? Well, what's the learning? So building that notion of learning into it, very interesting from my point of view as essentially an organizational cretin. So I'm going to do three things today. I'm going to talk about why learning. I'm going to talk about what, particularly one big factor in learning, and thirdly, the how we might maximize learning. And I'm talking both about individuals and organizations here, because organizations are made up of individuals, we're made up of brains, the most complex entities in the known universe. I'm going to start by asking you to think of something you really, as an individual, really, really want over the next 5 years. Needn't be in your organization, just something you really, really would love to have happen in the next 5 years. Just close your eyes for a minute. Try and summon up something in your life you would really love to have. And think big. And many of you can come up with something. You should put up your hands if you can think of something that occurs to you. It's not easy, okay. And now I'm going to ask you, what sort of things go through your mind as you think of that big something? What sort of things occur to you? Any thoughts? Yes?
I'm thinking warmth for a reason.
Warmth. Yeah. You're thinking what?
Warmth.
Warmth, yeah. Warmth.
As in inside and outside.
Yeah, it's a glow.
Yeah.
It's feeling in your stomach, right?
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
Anything else?
Fear.
Thank you. You're such a brilliant audience. I thought I was going to have to probe and... Yes, of course. Warmth, the glow of anticipation, and the fear. What if? What if that doesn't? So you have just encapsulated really probably the defining aspect of human brain and existence. And that is that balance between the warm anticipation of reward and the fearful anticipation of publishing. And that is all the species, including the human species, are caught in that dilemma of going forward in anticipation of what we want and need, and withdrawal from the potential negatives, the punishing things. Approach and avoidance. There's all sorts of other words that go with this. There's a whole scientific literature around the promotion mindset, which is the warmth, anticipating glow of achievement, versus the preventative mindset, the taking steps to prevent the fearful things happening. So, can we just throw open that notion of the warm anticipation of success or achieving that thing you were thinking of in 5 years' time versus the fear of what might happen as a result of taking that step, or it might not happen? Can you all just close your eyes and think about your own goal or your own thing you want to happen in 5 years? And try and introspect about the sort of cognitive thinking, emotional, what kind of things, how do you see your mind operating between these two? So try and switch between the ambitious warmth and the fearful fear. Try and switch between these two modes and try and identify in your own mind differences in what's going on in your mind. Just take a moment, close your eyes, and try and switch between these two. Did anyone observe or notice anything about the states of mind between these two? Any volunteers? Yes?
One side feels optimistic, the other is like pessimistic.
Yes.
So
yes, optimistic. Optimistic is expecting good things to happen, and pessimistic is expecting either good things not to happen or bad things to happen. So yes. So there's a projection into the future and an anticipation. Anything else? Yes.
It feels like two sides of your brain. There's like bifurcation.
Jesus. Where do you get these people from? That's absolutely what happens. The anticipation of reward, the warm feeling, comes because there's activation of the dopamine system in the reward network in the middle of your brain, and that activates more the left frontal cortex of the brain. And so going forward, actually turns you slightly rightward. The anxious, dreading, fear, or nervous anticipation of punishment activates the noradrenaline system, looks through this in the brain, spreads noradrenaline through your brain, part of the fight or flight system, activates the right frontal cortex and tends to turn you slightly leftwards. So you're absolutely right. Okay, perfect. Any other thoughts going through your mind between these two states? Yes?
I was just going to say there's a slight physical reaction as well. I felt the fearful was connected with a more sort of feeling in the throat of like that, whereas the calm feeling.
That's the fight or flight system, the hypothalamic pituitary axis of your brain, which is preparing your body for action, either to run away or to fight the foe. So it's pumping cortisol into your blood, increasing adrenaline, which in turn increases noradrenaline. So it's putting you in a state of readiness, which is very useful in the short term, but long term is not very good for you. Okay? Any other observations? Yes?
I found it much easier to do one than the other.
Which one?
The negative.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So there are differences between people and organizations in their proneness to these two states. Any other thoughts? Yes?
The negative felt limiting and kind of like cyclical, and the positive felt more freeing.
That's so interesting. So, what these two states do is they fundamentally alter your brain and the balance between the two systems of the brain. And what the warm glow of ambitious anticipation of success does is to focus your attention on an anticipated future success or goal. And that warm feeling is because of increased dopamine activity in the reward network. So you're there with the goal in advance. That dopamine is a natural antidepressant and a natural anti-anxiety drug. That's why richer people are happier, which they are. Successful people are happier because they're getting this natural antidepressant, natural anti-anxiety drug, daily, hourly. Cortisol levels in their body are lower, and so their organs get less degraded by chronic cortisol, and so they live longer, they live healthier. Difference between a person in Chelsea and a person in Carlton in Glasgow is 20 years of healthy life. 9 years of physical life, 20 years of healthy life. Life without illness. And that's because, to a large part, these systems and how they play out in the body. So what we've seen there is the role of attention. So people who feel empowered and optimistically anticipating the reward, and organizations that feel that way, are very good at envisaging the goal and anticipating the success of achieving that goal, and that makes their attention, empowers them with their attention focused on a goal. And if your attention is focused on a goal, you're more likely to achieve it. Whereas in the other state, in the fearful state, being fearful, which is more likely if you're powerless or poor or low down in an organization, it's all relative, it's not absolute, your attention has to be broadly spread. Why? Because you don't have the same power to be able to anticipate the successful achievement of the goal. And you have to be anticipating what other horrible things might come out of left field that I haven't thought of because I'm not in control. And so your attention has to be broadly spread to anticipate potential threats. Okay? And that means you're less likely to be able to achieve a goal because the brain systems for organizing your behavior to achieve goals are otherwise occupied in this emergency scanning of the horizon for threat. That's why poor people are less cognitively able. Not because of any genetics. Well, genetics play a part. Let's forget genetics. We can't do anything about that. But poverty not only impoverishes you physically, not only makes you sick, it also makes you cognitively less able to do the stuff. So we have effects on our emotion, optimism, pessimism. We have effects on our goal focus. We have effects on our mood. We have effects on our physical health. We have effects on our attention. Narrow, focused, optimistic goal versus wide, what the hell's going to happen to me? And we have effects on our memory. Because in this state, in this state where the half of your brain is eagerly anticipating the goal, your attention is now primed to notice evidence of your success. So your attention system is primed to look for evidence that you're doing well. So in that state, confident optimism, I notice the people who are looking interested and smiley, and I don't notice the people who are looking bored or sleepy. Switch to the other state, which has happened to me, I assure you, many times, and that bugger is asleep in the front row. You cannot keep your eyes off. No one here. This bugger there, who's asleep in the front row, or who's sitting with a big frown in the front row, that your attention hones in on that and multiplies that feedback and interferes with your ability to perform and slows down time, and your words fall like bricks from your mouth to the ground. Okay? So these are the two states. So it's your attention. But also, your memory systems are similarly biased. So in the warm glow of ambition, you can remember, positive memories come much more easily to mind. Previous successes. In the opposite state of fearful anticipation, negative, past failures, past humiliations come into your mind more readily. And so you get these vicious cycles. One a virtuous cycle, one a vicious cycle can happen. And so people can get pushed down into or lifted up into either of these states. But of course, neither state in this extreme is desirable. The last thing you want for an organization or a CEO or a chief financial officer is that they're in constant gung-ho state of mind where they're anticipating only gold. That's what happened in 2008, all around here. The traders 100 meters from here were not, their brains were so primed with bonuses and with, some of them with cocaine, because cocaine acts in exactly the same center of the brain as the one that is activated when you anticipate success in 5 years' time, the traders couldn't even remember. It didn't occur to them about past crashes, about the idea of bubbles didn't come into their minds. That's the bull market mentality. And then when the bear market comes, it happened for 10 years in Japan, the bear market comes, and you can't remember past successes. And so people get trapped into saving and trapped into not spending because all they can remember, their attention is focused on future threats and their memory is focused on past failures and past negative events. So it's a balance. We need a balance. Any organization needs a risk assessment. Any organization needs the cautious accountant and the gung-ho CEO working together. That's the two halves of the brain. So, okay, because I've been interacting more than, I won't speak for terribly much longer. I'll throw a few.
Worried I'm picking these.
So let's bear in mind this approach and avoidance. Goal seeking versus fear, goal avoiding, fear avoiding. So, all of you in this room, including myself, we all differ in our basic motivations of why we learn. Why do we learn? Because there has to be a motivation to learn. If learning is uncomfortable, it's much easier to go along doing what stuff you're doing than thinking of the weekend. Learning is hard. So why do we do it? So there's three basic motivations. And all of you in this room will differ in your recipe for these motivations. So think about this in respect of it's actually easier to do. Think of this in respect of colleagues. Because it's much harder to introspect these about yourself, but you can about yourself as well. So the three basic motivations are of human behavior in general. Acceptance, the need to be liked and accepted by the group. Second one is achievement. The need to be recognized for your accomplishments. And the third one is power, your desire to have control and impact over what other people want, need, or fear. us in this room differ in that balance. I put up my hand. I only discovered this when I did the pro vice chancellor's role for 3 years. I don't have a huge appetite for power. I've got a pathetically high desire for achievement. And I really like being accepted for other people. It makes me a poor manager. Okay. So, think about yourself. Think about yourself and your colleagues. Where do they stand in that three? Acceptance, achievement, and power. These are all approach motivations. These are all about going forward. Okay? Getting that prize, getting that paper published, getting that grant, or becoming CEO, or controlling this sector, or getting that money. That money is very much of a control for many people. Or getting that popularity. So these are the three approach motivations. Can you think of the, because remember, we're caught in the balance between approach and avoidance, between goal seeking and fear. What are the corresponding fears for these three motivations? What are the corresponding fears? Let's take acceptance. What's the corresponding fear that goes with that?
Rejection.
Fear of rejection. That is the greatest source of stress for all human beings, for most human beings, as measured by cortisol secretion. The fear of negative evaluation of other people is the greatest fear for most people. Second one, achievement. What's the corresponding fear of failure? Fear of failure. A huge motivating driver for some people. And what about power? What's the corresponding fear to do with the power motivation?
Poverty?
Yeah, what goes with poverty?
Lack
of control. Loss of control. So you will have worked in your organizations. You will have worked with people who are your bosses, or people who work for you, or colleagues, whose motivations are shaped by that in different ways, by their need for achievement versus their fear of failure, their need for power versus their fear of loss of control, and their need for acceptance versus the fear of rejection. And the whole organization's learning can be distorted grossly if any of these are depending on the precise balance of these motivations that you're working with. And just one little tip, if you're thinking of promoting someone, managers who want to be liked more than they enjoy power generally are poorer managers, because they can't make tough decisions. They want to be liked too much and they're overstressed. So power motivation is not something that's negative. It can be, but to be an effective leader, you have to want to have an impact and control. Otherwise, you find it too stressful. And having power actually has the same effect as anticipating success on your brain. It's a natural antidepressant and a natural anti-anxiety drug. So being put into a position of power, although the responsibilities are greater, nature has evolved that we end up able to hold that better if we have the appetite for power. So I'm just going to finish briefly, and then I'm going to briefly touch on the other two things I was going to say. Just briefly finish to say that there's two aspects of power. There's a basic primitive enjoyment of being calling the shots, of being the boss. Okay? That's the basic appetite. It increases testosterone in both men and women. That increases dopamine, changes your brain function to put you more in that reward anticipating, optimistic, confident, charismatic, visionary frame of mind. And anyone who's going to be in a position of leadership, it's got to have a certain, it has to have that fuel, because that's the basic fuel. The trouble is, too much of it can become addictive because it hits the same system as cocaine, and we see awful examples of that throughout the world in leaders. So what constrains it? One of the things that constrains it is the feeling that your power is on behalf of a group and not just of yourself. So the first one is the primitive one, is P power. The second one is S power. S power is where you want to have an impact, you want to have control, but it's on behalf of X, Y, Z. Okay? Your ego is less central to it. And that S power and P power coexist, or can coexist in people. So Obama, you can analyze these motivations in people's free language. Obama had high levels of P power, as he has to be as president, but also high levels of S power. And S power acts as a kind of snake bite antidote. Okay, it actually reduces the addictive properties of power. George W. Bush had high levels of P power, very low levels of S power. Okay? And Tony Blair, unfortunately, got into a state where he started off with reasonable levels of S power. He lost the run of himself and made terrible decisions because power about the Iraq War, because power interferes in too high a dose, interferes with brain function. These are some of the biggest obstacles to learning in organizations. So I've done the why, and the what is about ego, because all of these ambitions, all of these motivations, these approach motivations are largely about ego, to be liked, to be recognized for achievement, but to be in control. Okay, so I was going to talk about ego, and we'll come back to that. And the third thing I was going to say, and I will say in the course of the discussion, is about the how and some of the protections I get for a learning organization. And one of the greatest protections is values. It's one of the great protections for the ego. So someone humiliates you, you feel rejected, you feel humiliated by someone who's in a meeting or in some situation where you fail. One of the greatest, and the resulting response to that tends to be defensive behavior. And we've all seen, worked with people where organizations are ruined by the ego-defending behavior of key people. But one of the ways of reducing that heart of rejection, of negative evaluation of others, is to simply affirm your values, your basic values. I am committed to X. I am essentially a person. Your ego becomes slightly submerged in the value in the value you espouse verbally to yourself or to others or in writing. That's called self-affirmation, an incredibly powerful way. Second one is goals, being very good at setting goals for yourself and getting that little boost of dopamine that occurs from achieving these goals. And the third one, which is totally appropriate for this organization, is a culture of self-monitoring. Which we can do as individuals and organizations. Making self-monitoring part of our daily life. Now, of course, some people end up paralyzed by self-monitoring. Very anxious people can end up just being far too aware of themselves. So you have to bridge this gap, this constant tension between taking stock and self-monitoring on the one hand, and eager anticipation and progress towards your goals as achieving that balance. I hope that was too long just to kick off. I'm happy to have any thoughts or comments now. Yeah.
Thank you. It's going to be a challenge for anyone to stand up and look out at the audience now and we'd like you to take a couple of minutes to get me out of this hole by just reflecting a little bit on what Ian has said. Talk to the person next to you if you want, but or talk to yourself. I thought that was quite helpful, getting us to talk to ourselves earlier, about what this might mean for our, particularly for, remember, our topic today is making learning every day, and this very, the powerful implications of who we are, what we bring into those settings. And then there'll be a little 10 minutes or so for some comments or opinions or indeed questions. So just take a couple of minutes and then we'll come back. I think we'll We're trying to model the perfect way of bringing people back into a group here without looking that I'm too one thing and not the other. Okay, the general hubbub dies down. You are going to need to project, I'm afraid, from the back. I don't know if we've got a... Have we got a mic? No, we don't have a mic.
There's a mic here.
I don't know if it works. Anyway, oh, sorry. nervous about looking too powerful but not controlling enough. Oh, God. Did he, when he went through the list, did you think, oh, God, I'm kind of all of those, which makes me just, like, confused and presumably confusing. We want to avoid too much of a kind of traditional Q&A. On the other hand, Ian has got some material that he didn't use that he'll weave artfully into answers. It's like, never mind the question, here's the answer. Like when you revise two topics for an exam and the questions don't come up, you have to bend the question to your will. But thoughts, observations, as well as questions is absolutely fine. So please, we've got about 10 or so minutes. Yeah. On it.
Just a comment really. I think what was interesting was that, like you say, we were perhaps all thinking all of the elements of that and how you unlock that and how much the leadership, the qualities of the leadership or whoever's leading your team can play a part in that. So if you've got somebody who's probably quite, you know, committed to the values and the issues and the S power, but using perhaps too much of the P power, which then would unlock the fear and anxiety amongst the team. And so it's quite good to just reflect on how much you use that P power in the organisation, and if there's other ways of kind of encouraging that learning, which is obviously what today's all about. But that was the thing that kind of really resonated with me, like that leadership.
I tell you, many NGOs have collapsed because of key people. Having that too much of that kind of motivation. And if I can just say, in terms of the theme of today's group and of you as evaluators, what I didn't mention in this competition between the two hemispheres of the brain is that the more this go-getter, optimistic, charismatic goal anticipation is activated, it is in competition with the other half of the brain, which is to do with anxiety and fear, but also relates to empathy and self-awareness. So the more you're in this state of eager anticipation, the less self-aware you become and the less empathic you become. And that means you're not, it's very, very difficult if you're someone at the apex of an organization. Nobody wants to speak, a lot of people don't want to speak truth to power because it can have repercussions in a person whose self-awareness has been diminished, whose empathy has been diminished, biologically, by the effects of power. So that's why there's only two sets of constraints for that kind of power. One is internal, one is external. Internal, really, you can only get when you're selecting people for power. And what you look for is evidence in their free speech of the words no, don't, and shouldn't. These are evidence of internal constraints. They may be ethical, they may be moral, they may be professional, but just listen for the no, don'ts, and shouldn'ts. And that's there's a lot of them in Obama's language, for instance. The other one is external governance constraints. We have audit committees, we have risk committees. We do not have power committees. But big companies like Microsoft have caught on to this, and they have 360-degree assessments, which can be fairly stressful. But you're getting assessed, you're not just doing your annual assessment of the person above you, the people below you. And that's what you really see. And that constrains power. So you have to have good governance and constraints, and that's why democracy was developed, free press, independent judiciary. Elections were all constrained way to constrain the power of leaders, because we need leaders. We need leaders who have an appetite for power, but we need to constrain it.
Tom?
Could you say something about the life cycle? Because there may be... have suggested that these are static conditions, both for the individual and for the organisation.
Fantastic, and I want to add gender to that as well.
Yeah. Ian, would you just repeat roughly the question?
The question was, can I talk about life cycle, because I'm implying these are static conditions, which they're not. And that's why the financial crash was largely young to middle-aged men who are particularly prone to this because of the high testosterone levels and the cultural aspects of masculinity. Had there been more women involved, you would have less, the probability of that crash would have been less. And had there been more older people with experience and wisdom, that would have happened as well. Because as we get older, our testosterone levels get lower. And the evidence is this S power that I talked about, women have higher levels on average of S power. That's why we need the balance in boards and senior management between the genders and also the ages.
Hi. We're very focused in our organisation, and I think quite a lot of other people are in the room around, we're sort of calling it lived experience, which is not the right way to put it, and I'm not sure the right way to put it, but, you know, we're trying to tell the story of people, and actually why don't we find those people to tell their own experiences. And we're very aware of the power that we have in linking those people up, but I suppose I'm trying to look at that acceptance, achievement, power, and how we may leave a person who is, you know, brought to a meeting, talks about the challenges they've had, who, you know, doesn't really have power beyond that moment of someone listening. And if you have any sort of thoughts or feedback for me in terms of the kind of, you know, the acceptance, achievement, you know, the short time high that they might get from that story, and but then where they might be later, and what's my kind of duty of care.
What an interesting question, and you're right. Whenever you make someone either a participant in a research project or a participant in that way, you are simultaneously disempowering and empowering them. So you're putting them into a different state of mind where they see alternative possibilities, which can be either very good or very bad for them. So I think the idea there is to maybe take a slightly action research approach to someone like that. They've got a lived experience, they've been through a terrible thing, is to say, well, look, can we help you establish any goals or take any steps out of this lived experience? And can we help you in any way to, even if it's a tiny step, because sometimes people feel so disempowered, they can't even anticipate a small goal, and therefore they're deprived of the little antidepressant surge that comes from defining a goal and achieving it, no matter how small.
Other questions, comments, thoughts?
We were just, in our pair, we were just talking about motivation. And you mentioned, you know, the motivating factors about learning, but yeah, so it's about kind of discovering, how do you discover different people's motivations for learning, and how do you kind of create the opportunity for that to happen?
So that's a great question. So one. Apart from ego, other probably principal obstacle to learning is what Carol Dweck calls the fixed versus change mindset. So, but it ties into the ego. So, can I have 2 minutes just to
please? Yes.
Because it's true of, it's so fundamental. So our approach to learning depends on our theories about ourselves. And this is true both for emotional learning and intellectual learning. So, if you believe that, for instance, your intelligence or your personality or your emotional state is a thing that you have, that you were born with, or was injected into you as part of the fabric of your where you were brought up, then that theory almost mitigates against learning because it induces a fatalism, what I call the curse of genetic fatalism, passivity. And it happens even for, so say for instance, the worst thing you can say to a kid is you're really bright. Because what you're doing there is you're telling them they have a thing called brightness, intelligence. And that's them. And that makes them feel very good. The trouble is, they go into school age 13 and they fail or get a low score in the maths test. And whereas a kid who has a changed mindset, who realises what they are is a combination of circumstances, a result of good teaching, hard work, partly genetic perhaps, compared to the changed mindset person, the fixed mindset person says, maybe I'm not bright. It becomes a threat to the ego. And you actually study the brains of kids like that. So you give them a general knowledge test. And you say, you know, what's the capital of Germany? Okay? And a bright kid, gives the wrong answer and says, Bonn. And you say, wrong. That kid's brain responds completely different to a kid who has a changed mindset. What happens is there's a huge wave at the frontal lobe of the brain called a P3, which is a kind of, what the hell was that wave? Maybe I'm not bright, I got that wrong. But what's more, you then tell them the right answer, actually it's Berlin, and then later on you go back and ask them, again, what's the capital of Germany? The bright kid with the fixed mindset, who had this big wave in the brain, doesn't remember, doesn't learn the correct answer. Because their brain processing has been entirely focused and repairing this threat to the ego. A huge amount of our intellectual capital in the House of Commons, we've seen it the other night, everywhere we see it, this huge amount of mental energy in the human race that's spent trying to repair damage to the ego of that kind. And that's why the whole notion of learning built into systems and to people is inherent in that is a change mindset. Inherent in that is that I'm not fixed. You know, that the change is always in the air. Our brains are plastic, we're constantly changing depending on who we are and who we're with and what we're doing. They're physically shaped moment to moment by this meeting here. And so if you have that change mindset, it means I am in the flow of experience. I am not this thing called my clever, you know, ego. And it happens the other way with people who, I'll stop in a minute. Kids who are have a fixed mindset of their personality. I'm a shy person. I'm X, I'm Y, I'm Z, this is who I am. Kids who have that kind of mindset, and then in that critical stage of adolescence, 13, 14, when relationships are changing, they get rejected from a group, as happens always. The kids with a fixed mindset are much more likely to withdraw and not try again, not learn from the experience, because they take this as further evidence that this is how I am. Whereas a kid who has a change mindset about their personality will more likely say, they're a right bunch of twerps, I'm going to find another group, okay? And so the change mindset is one of the greatest inhibitors to learning. Sorry, the fixed mindset is one of the greatest inhibitors to learning. Organizations have it as well. We are the lords of the manor club. We've been here since, you know, 1906. We've always been on this. This is who we are. These organizations go down the tubes.
Ian, could you close with some tips on how you support and build change mindset in an organization? And in the individuals that you're...
So there have been wonderful studies, Tanya, because African Americans, for instance, and women are often, because of the cultural beliefs, are disempowered and do badly in things like maths and IQ tests, particularly. Partly because their brain system, the moment they think it's an IQ test, the brain systems become occupied with preparing for threats to the ego, and they do that depletes their brains of resources and they do worse than the IQ test, or in women's case, a maths test or spatial test. And so the studies that have been done are very simple. You give them a little. You say, the brain is plastic. This is what happens. You just give this lecture to them.
Nice.
You give this lecture to them. And you can. People are clever. The brain's the most complex entity they know in the universe. You can produce fundamental changes in the brain with a few words. And you can say, look, your brain is not fixed. Your personality is not fixed. Your emotional state is not fixed. Your intelligence is not fixed. These are all because the brain is plastic. We only have 20,000 genes. 20,000 genes isn't enough to compute your behaviours and your capacities. It's just too few genes. So we evolved to be a learning species. That's what plasticity is, learning. So we evolved to learn. That's how we've survived and done so well. And so this way, anything about your behaviour is changing. And if you give that story, you can be an antidote to that. And then giving people the power to set goals for themselves and get that empowering antidepressant boost that comes from achieving goals and success.
Biodegradable plastic, obviously.
Yes.
So thank you. I thought it was bomb. I say bomb, you say wrong. Thank you very much. I'm hugely grateful, and I think that is the segue we want, really, is about plasticity. The march of the plastics is what we're now going to look at for the rest of the day. We're very grateful to you for coming.
No, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
Come again.
And thanks for teaching me all I've learned about evaluation and quality.